Chapter 1. Europe in the 18th century. Question first. Describe the important features of the history of Europe from 1789 to 1871. Answer. It is very difficult to demarcate the study of history period-wise, but sometimes it becomes essential to classify the historical periods for a better understanding of the subject. Therefore, the period of the history of Europe from 1789 to 1871 can be divided into two significant parts. First, from 1789 to 1815, and second, from 1815 to 1871. The first part, 1789 to 1815, deals with the history of rise and fall of the French Revolution and the reign of Napoleon Bonaparte in France. C. D. Hazen, an eminent historian, has thrown light on the emergence of the modern history during this period in these words. From 1789, European history emerged into the history of one nation, one event, and one man. The nation is that of France, the event is the French Revolution, and the man is Napoleon Bonaparte. The condition of Europe before the outbreak of the French Revolution was most precarious. Whole of Europe was surrounded with troubles both in social and political spheres. Poverty and paucity were the order of the day, and inequality prevalent among the masses had created chaos and confusion throughout the continent. Autocracy and despotism were flourishing during the 18th century. All the European countries were influenced by the revolutionary currents of the contemporary period. France also could not remain an exception to these influences, and the advent of Industrial Revolution, colonial expansion, and the American Revolution had a tremendous impact on it. It affected the entire thinking of the French people, and they began to brood over the circumstances of their country. There gradually developed feelings of distaste and hatred towards the autocratic rulers of France, and the people began to contemplate its overthrow by a revolutionary movement. They were very much annoyed with the corrupt bureaucracy, as they were always subjected to severe punishments and unequal treatment by it. The revolutionary thought was readily accepted by the disappointed and dejected people, as they saw a new ray of hope of their salvation in it. But instead of doing any good to the people, this revolutionary spirit increased their difficulties to a great extent. The inexperienced and selfish people, after having taken the strings of revolution in their grip, handled it wrongly, thereby rendering the situation all the more deplorable. With the passage of time, it was soon realized that instead of doing any good to the people or weaning away others from wickedness, these new leaders themselves became guilty of bloodshed and perpetrated horrors. We notice a striking progress in Europe during the period spanning the French Revolution and the modern times. On the eve of the French Revolution, absolute monarchy based on the doctrine of divine right of kings was a prevailing form of government in most of the states of Europe. According to this, the king was considered to be the representative of God on earth and was supposed to derive his authority from him. There was an ostensible dearth of democratic thinking. The people had no right to disobey the monarch. The tyrannical monarchs used to boast that they represent God on this planet and their will is law. But the French Revolution gave the final blow to feudalism and the doctrine of the divine right of kings. This now the mills and factories were quite unknown. A majority of people in the 18th century were agriculturists. They lived in villages and were divided into two classes, the nobles and the peasantry. This classification was incidentally based on birth. The peasantry was further divided into two classes, the freemen and the serfs. The farmers had no scientific knowledge of agriculture. They used to work hard on their lands from sunrise to sunset with their crude implements. Peasants generally lived from hand to mouth due to the meager sustenance derived from the land. During this period, women had no social freedom. Their entire life was confined within the four walls of the house. The only vocation in life for a woman was the domestic drudgery. The religious attitudes of the nations were fanatic. No religious harmony characterized the followers of different religions. The Protestants and the Roman Catholics were still at daggers drawn with each other. These factors, which at present characterize the European countries as the dignified and civilized ones, were out of imagination at that time. At present, there is hardly any country in Europe where we do not find the democratic setup in one form or the other. The monarchical form of government no more exists now, and the theory of the divine right of kings has also disappeared. Insofar as the study of history is concerned, it is not very convenient to take the year 1789 as ushering in the advent of modern European history, because changes in society do not take place immediately. They occur with a gradual process in slow but steady form. Just as we cannot mark a distinction between the childhood and adolescence and youth and the old age at one definite point, similarly, demarcation of historical periods is very difficult. Hence, the last date of medievalism is uncertain, but in order to facilitate the study of history, historians have regarded 1789 to be the beginning of the modern European history. Now, important features of history of Europe from 1815 to 1870. The period from 1815 to 1870 is a very significant one in the history of Europe. During this period, the contemporary political giants endeavored their best to patch up the readjust the Catholic conditions of Europe. After the defeat of Napoleon in the Battle of Waterloo and his exile to the island of St. Helena, the Age of Congress appeared on the scene. The four congresses at Aix-la-Chapelle in 1818, at Troppau in 1820, at Liebeck in 1821, and at Verona in 1822, tried to solve the burning problems of Europe. But the four big powers, that are Great Britain, Austria, Prussia, and Russia, failed to maintain harmony among their ideals. The Congress of Vienna made the mistake of discarding the principles of nationality, while the intellectuals of the day were fired with the spirit of nationalism. The new tidal wave of nationalism tended to smash up the obsolete conservation idealism. Now about Congress of Vienna. After Napoleon's fall in 1814 and his retirement to the island of Elba, a Congress of European diplomats was summoned to meet at Vienna to give peace to the wearied generation and to deal with a number of political problems which were sucking the blood of nations. All big and small countries of Europe, except Turkey, were invited in this Congress. Vienna, the capital of Austria, was chosen as the venue, and Chancellor Count Metternich was selected to preside over it. In the meanwhile, Napoleon came back from Elba and he started waging wars again. The army of the Allied nations finally defeated him in the Battle of Waterloo and exiled him to the island of St. Helena. During the course of proceedings of the Vienna Congress, the city was decorated lavishly. There were several burning problems facing the Congress, and its members were busy in maneuvering to grind their own axe. Though it did not survive for a long time, yet it could solve some very intricate problems of the day and played a very significant role in the historical development of the 19th century Europe. Now, the Concert of Europe. To maintain mutual amity among nations, the Concert of Europe was established. Tsar Alexander of Russia organized Holy Alliance and tried to maintain peace in Europe through congresses. But since no other great power except Russia, Austria, and Prussia sincerely had faith in its principles, the Holy Alliance was a dead letter from its very inception. As the constant wars waged by Napoleon had affected the economy of all the European countries adversely, the chief aim of the Concert of Europe was to maintain peace and order in the society and to put the economy of different nations back on the rails. Hence, the existence of the Concert of Europe was the need of the day, for everyone wanted to help avert all the possibilities of a future war. Now, the Revolution, 1830 to 1848. The French Revolution failed to give the desired result. as after the revolution, autocracy was again established in France. But the Bourbons failed to satisfy the public, and the Orleanists occupied the throne. They too ruled contrary to the wishes of the people of France, which led to the outbreak of the Revolution of 1830. It was also crushed by the European despots with the help of Metternich, the Chancellor of Austria. The Revolution of 1830 was succeeded by another revolution of 1848. It blazed like wildfire. Metternich was very much terrified, seeing the horrible outburst of this revolution, and fled away from Austria. In certain kingdoms, the constitutions based on the democratic principles were enforced by the kings themselves. Now, the Industrial Revolution. The emergence of the Industrial Revolution brought about several changes in Europe. Trade and commerce flourished rapidly. Several new scientific inventions came into being, and the technical knowledge of the European countries advanced. The greed of territorial expansion gave rise to the spirit of international competition. The standard of living of the people shot up due to rapid advancements in various spheres of life. Now, the Eastern question. The historians hold divergent opinions about the Eastern question, as it had tremendous complications. An eminent historian had compared it with detestable gout, which at different times grips different parts of the human body. This vexed problem became susceptible to various changes in its form from time to time. The rule of Turkish Empire proved all the more detrimental to the interests of the European nations. Now about unification of Italy and Germany. The first lesson of vigorous nationalism was imparted to Italy and Germany by Napoleon, the Emperor of France. The leaders of Italy, such as Mazzini, Garibaldi, and Cavour, raised high slogans for the unification of Italy and did human service to their country. Though they did not succeed in their mission in the beginning, that did not crush their spirits. Ultimately, their patriotism and nationalism gained the upper hand and Italy was united. Metternich was the arch enemy of Italy and Germany both. He was, from the core of his heart, against the unification of both the countries. Up to 1848, he continued to put obstacles in the smooth way of unification of these countries, but Bismarck, the shrewd politician of Europe, ultimately succeeded in his mission, and with the unification of Germany in 1870, the dreams of the German patriots came to be true. Bismarck is still remembered in Germany as the greatest among the great sons of Germany. Owing to his far-sighted policies, which helped him a lot in the process of the unification. Now, points to remember. The period of European history from 1789 to 1870 can be divided into two parts. First, 1789 to 1815, and second, 1815 to 1870. Now the first, general conditions of Europe were awfully deplorable. Second, it was a period of revolutions. Third, Europe was not advanced in science and technology. People did not know about railways, telegraphs, and the aeroplanes. Fourth, the agriculture too was not in a developed state. The life of the farmers was troublesome. Fifth, autocracy of the European rulers could not be crushed even after revolutions. Sixth, the Congress of Vienna tried to rebuild Europe after the wars of Napoleon. Seventh, the Concert of Europe was organized to maintain peace and order in Europe on the principles of Christianity. Eighth, the Revolution of 1830 and 1848 led to the establishment of the democratic constitutions in many states of Europe in due course of time. Ninth, the Industrial Revolution proved helpful for the progress of science, art, and other branches of knowledge. Tenth, the Eastern Question proved to be a great hurdle in the way of peace and prosperity. 11th, unification of Italy and Germany tended a lot to the rise of patriotism and nationalism. Mazzini, Garibaldi, and Cavour played a major role in the unification of Italy, while Bismarck managed the unification of Germany by his own wit and diplomacy. Now, question number 2. Describe the social condition of Europe on the eve of the French Revolution. Answer. During the 18th century, Europe was not only divided politically, but on the social plane also. The people were divided into various classes. Among them were the nobles, the higher clergy, the lower clergy, the peasantry, the craftsmen, and the slaves. This division of the society was based on property and political rights. The privileged among all the classes were the nobles and the clergy. The laborers and peasants were at the lowest rungs in the society. They were unprivileged and enjoyed no rights. The position of clergymen was also honorable. They had several privileges. The position of all the three classes can be understood clearly by this popular saying. The nobles were to pray, the clergy were to pray, and the masses were to pay. First, pray is P-R-E-Y. Second, pray is P-R-A-Y. The first two categories had not to pay any tax, but all the same, enjoyed various privileges, while the general masses were burdened with taxes and had no special privilege to enjoy. This inequality in European society created a great gulf between the privileged and the unprivileged, which could not be bridged by the contemporary rulers and created havoc. Now the nobles. The nobles had and feudal lords had unlimited rights and privileges. They possessed immense influence in the courts and held sway in the government machinery. The highest offices in the state were filled by the members of the noble class. There was a practice of auction for some posts, and the members of the noble class, being wealthy, generally occupied these posts due to their highest bids. They used to practice several cruelties and atrocities on the common people in order to extract money from them. They had the ownership on all the land, but they never tilled it. The responsibility of tilling the land was only of the serfs and the lords. Moreover, these serfs were compelled to pay various arbitrary taxes and present gifts to their lords. They had to work on the private lands of their masters for 6 days in a week without getting any wages for their labor. So they had only nights to work in their own fields. The hunting parties and the animals of the nobles used to enter in the fields of the poor farmers and did great harm to the standing crops. But the farmer had no right to make a complaint against this loss. They had to remain silent spectators to all these damages. The nobles had their own flour mills, ovens, bakeries, and distilleries, and the people living on their estates had to deal only with these establishments. Thus, they augmented their income and led luxurious life. They were in a far better position than the common masses. With the establishment of absolute monarchy, most of their rights were curtailed. Even then, their life was full of pomp and show and luxuries. They lived in palatial buildings and enjoyed many special privileges. They had unlimited income but paid no taxes to the government. Now the clergy. The ecclesiastics, like the nobles and feudal lords, enjoyed various privileges in the European society. The clergymen were divided into two categories. First, the upper clergy, who had fabulous wealth and lived in monasteries, and second, the lower clergy, who lived among the common people and performed all the religious rites and led a very pure life. The cardinals, archbishops, bishops and the abbots formed the upper class clergy. They lived a very luxurious life due to wealth and property of the church lying in their possession. C. D. Hazen remarks, "Much of the income went to the higher clergy. The Archbishop of Strasbourg had an income of $3 lakhs a year. A few of the bishops received small incomes, but the average was over $50,000 a year. Moreover, the members of the upper clergy had no faith even in the existence of God. Louis XVI, once at the time of appointment of the Archbishop in Paris, remarked, "At least for Paris, we should have such an archbishop who may have faith in the existence of God." The members of the higher clergy like the nobles, were exempted from payment of taxes to the government. The lower clergy constituted curates, parsons, and friars. Parsons belonging to the lower ranks of the church were poor, but educated and learned. They were well versed in performing religious rites. Apart from the performance of their religious duties, they used to educate the people and provide medicine to the sick villagers. They remained busy from sunrise to sunset, but their income was very meager. Hardly they could earn enough to make both ends meet. They had to depend on the mercy of the village people. They hated the members of the upper clergy and felt envious of them, owing to their luxurious and comfortable life, which they were enjoying without any merit of their own. The members of the lower clergy were influenced by the thoughts of the revolutionaries. The inequality between the upper clergy and the lower clergy gave birth to a deep gulf between the two. Now the common people, the artisans, craftsmen, masons, laborers, shopkeepers, and the tenants formed the common class of the people. They were about 85% of the total population of Europe. The common people were extremely troubled and tortured by the nobles and the upper clergy. People of this class were ill-clad and ill-fed. However, they had to pay all taxes. They used to pay about 80% of their income in the form of taxes. The nobles, feudal lords, high government officials, and the church all robbed them in their own way. Groaning under the burden of heavy taxation and exploitation, they lived a very miserable life below the subsistence level. They had to do much forced labor for the nobles and church, for which they were paid nothing. The life of the artisans, craftsmen, and laborers was also very troublesome. They were exploited by the traders who had formed the guilds. The regulations of these guilds were very strict. They paid little and took much work from the laborers and artisans, and thus exploited their manual labor. Now the middle class. Owing to the advent of the Industrial Revolution, a new class emerged in the European society, known as the middle class. This class embraced within its fold traders, industrialists, advocates, physicians, writers, and teachers. They had enough wealth and led a comfortable life. They were educated and industrious, but they did not enjoy any privilege like the nobles. They had a feeling of hatred for the nobles and the upper clergy because of their luxurious life and privileges. According to Kettlebay, their feelings of jealousy towards the noble fanned the flames of the French Revolution to a great extent. The above description reveals that the European society on the eve of the French Revolution was badly organized. Inequality and partiality were prevailing throughout the country. Schiavelli, an eminent historian, has observed, "The great structure of European society was unhappy, unfree, unprotected, undeveloped mass of human beings, to whom opportunity for growth and improvement was closed on every side. Now, points to remember. The European society was divided into four classes. First, nobles. Second, clergy. Three, commoners. And fourth, middle class. The nobles. It was the most influential and privileged class. The members of this class had several rights, but no duties. They had huge amount of wealth in their possession, but were exempted from all taxation by virtue of their being members of the nobility. In fact, they had to do nothing except leading a life full of pleasures and pomp and show. Now, the clergy. The clergy was further divided into two classes. First, the upper clergy, and second, the lower clergy. The life of upper clergy was luxurious and comfortable, and they held a high position in the society, while lower clergy led a pious life and observed all kinds of religious rites, but failed to meet the needs of their families. This inequality among the clergy created a great gulf between the ecclesiastics of Europe. Now, the common people. They formed a bulk of the European society, mostly artisans, farmers, and serfs constituted it. They had to work hard and to do much forced labor in the fields of the nobles, but they led a very miserable life. Ill-clad and ill-fed, they used to pass their life below the poverty line. They had to pay about 80% of their income in taxation. Now, the middle class. This class embraced within its fold traders, industrialists, advocates, physicians, writers and teachers. They had enough wealth and led a comfortable life. They were educated and industrious, but they did not enjoy any privilege like the nobles. They had a feeling of hatred for the nobles and the upper clergy because of their luxurious life and privileges. Thus, the European society on the eve of the French Revolution was based on gross inequality and partiality.